So we're in this new year of 5777, and October 22nd, 2016. I'm Brian Baruch Kvasnika, and we're going to be studying the Narkis parasha, which is unique. It's not like the traditional parasha. It's going back, an attempt to go back to the first century, triennial. I'm assuming some of you are new here. How many people are not regularly here at Narkis? Can you raise your hand? You're kind of here for the first time. So we've got a number. Okay, so it's good. Yeah. So the parasha, that is a Hebrew word that means Torah portion. Are you familiar with that word?
Yes.
Torah portion, yes? Okay, so there's a traditional Torah portion where we're ending Deuteronomy and beginning Genesis, right? That's in the traditional Jewish world. Narkis has taken upon itself, with Gary and Sharon, especially Ellie, to go back to a proposed, likely, first century Torah portion ordering, right? So that you don't cover the Torah in 1 year, you cover it in 3 years. And one of the significant differences is the portions related to the prophets, called the Haftarah, right? So the prophetic portions related to the Torah are different, right? So you don't have the normal Torah portions related to the prophets, right? Every week, as in Yeshua's time until today, in a synagogue, there is a Torah portion read, and there's a Haftarah that is given or preached on, yes? And that's the prophetic portion. So the prophetic portion is different, often different in the triennial reading. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So one of the goals of this Bible study for the past year, I guess, has been to try to read slowly, triennially, three years of a reading of the Torah, meaning the Pentateuch, and engage the prophetic portion, which has been attached to the Torah portion, which is different than the rabbinic understanding. And that opens up new ways of reading, new ways of understanding, because the Torah portions aren't the same, and they're maybe purposely not the same. That's what some people have argued, that Isaiah 53, for example, doesn't appear in the rabbinical prophetic portion. Does that make sense? So Isaiah 53 is very celebrated among Christians, but it's downplayed among rabbinic Jews because it is so celebrated among Christians. And so we find
the only reason why?
It's hard to know these causal things centuries ago. It's suggestive. Today we're going to be engaging Exodus chapter 6 and 7. The Torah portions are from Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 52, right? And there's Torah portions in the regular rabbinical stuff from 54 and 52, but not 53. So it's it is suggestive, right? So, this does allow some of the Torah readings that are in the, some of the prophetic readings are more messianic. It can be understood as more messianic. So, that allows us to think about that a little bit more. Maybe a general note too, and with this we'll finish the introduction on the triennial reading, is that it seems that different communities were reading the Torah and making prophetic connections on their own. Probably. There wasn't a set pattern. Sometimes it's 3 years, sometimes 3.5 years maybe. Some might have been a 1 year reading of the Torah. But each of these communities maybe had their own, or there was more diversity in connecting the prophetic passages back to the Torah. It's kind of the base text, the most authoritative text. In a way, kind of like the Gospels are for the Catholics and Orthodox Christians, right? The Gospels are paraded, much like the Torah is paraded, right? And so these are the base texts for the communities, the Torah and the Gospels. So anyway, so we're going to now dig into Exodus chapter 6, verses 2 through 7, chapter 7. So some of you are veterans of this Bible study and may have prepared ahead of time. I know one person next to me has.
And it's so,
Narkis.org. Yeah, it's at Narkis.org. So some of you have probably read this and are prepared to provide input, and that's great. Because this is the Feast of Tabernacle time period and there are many visitors, maybe it's nice also to read more extensively. Do you often do that? Sometimes. Yeah, so it's short. It's not a long passage, but so I think so that we can be on the same page, literally. Maybe we'll read at least the Torah portion, and then we'll jump around the prophetic portion, or peruse. So if everybody can turn to Exodus chapter 6, verse 2, and then we'll read through 7, chapter 7. Would someone volunteer to read nice and loudly a good chunk of that? Okay, you don't have to read the whole thing, but a good chunk, and we'll pass on to someone else. Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 through 7, chapter 7.
God also said to Moses, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, the Lord, Yahweh, I did not make myself fully known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I've heard the groaning of Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hands to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord.
Moses thus spoke to the people of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and harsh slavery. So the Lord said to Moses, go in, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am of uncircumcised lips. But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. These are the heads of their fathers' houses. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanoch, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben. The sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jahin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni and Shimei, by their clans. The sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, the years of the life of Kohath being 133 years. The sons of Merari, Mahli and Mushi, these are the clans of the Levites, according to their generations. Amram took as his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, the years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Izhar, Korah, Nephek, and Zichri. The sons of Uziel, Mishael, Elzaphan, and Sithri. Aaron took as his wife Elisheba, the daughter of Aminadab, and the sister of Nachshon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph. These are the clans of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans.
These are the same Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, bring up the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. These are the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are the same Moses and Aaron. And it came to pass on the day the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt that the Lord said to Moses, saying, I am the Lord. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said before the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh heed me? So the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may let my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people and the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them. So they did. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old, when they spoke to Pharaoh.
That's it. Thank you. That is our Torah portion for today. Thanks be to God. The reading of the Word. This is a shortened, for those who just came in, it's a shortened version. It's not the full version that's typically practiced, but this is what our focus is today, and we're going to be looking at the prophets in comparison. The prophetic passage that is in parallel to that is from Isaiah chapter 42. We won't turn there yet, but we'll have this in the back of their mind that we're going to be looking forward to reading or engaging Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 52. We have two different separate prophetic passages. I guess two different traditions have come down to us. Let's look at some of the highlights. If you were to imagine what would try to be tagged onto or held on together for the prophetic reading, if you're right, this is what's happening. The prophets, they're picking passages from the prophets that relate back to the Torah passage. So what are some of the main themes of this reading that we've just had that you would expect the ancient Jews to have connected with in prophetic passages? What are some of the key themes and highlights?
By my name.
By my name. Okay. What verse? If you say something that's great, please just kind of reference it for everybody to find it real quick.
6:2, by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them.
Okay.
And then repeat it all the way. He repeats his name. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. In 6:7, 8.
If he's saying that he wasn't known to Abraham, he's talking to Abraham by his name.
Right.
What did Abraham name the place where he was going to sacrifice Isaac?
Yeah. So this is a very good question. The name was already known. So hot. I mean, it was already used in the Book of Genesis prior to this. Let's unpack that in just a moment. It's a very nice tension that we can grab onto. Right now, I'd like just to call out highlights from the text, but let's come back and I promise we will not forget that question because it's a very important one.
I guess covenant.
Covenant. What verse?
Verse 4.
I established my covenant with them. Okay? There's lots of covenantal language in Jeremiah and Isaiah and betrothal. Yes? Okay? Any other highlights that you would expect the Jewish people to connect with?
His promises, I will.
In what verses?
There are many.
Yes.
7:3 is an example. I will harden Pharaoh's heart.
Okay. Yeah, 7:3 also has that. Some of the more, I was expecting you to lean back on like 6:6 and 6:7 with I will or I am or... Yeah, I will take...
There are seven I wills.
That's right. Seven verbs there that will have will in it, usually. But you picked out 7:3, which is interesting. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. So let's hold on to that also. That's a tension within the Scripture, that 7:3. So... that God is active. Maybe we can summarize what Gemma just said, and you, sir, I will. Right? He's active, and we have these seven verbs that are very redemptive, and function as a core for the Passover meal. Who else might share another highlight or two?
I will redeem you. What you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. Just to sharpen that a little bit, I will redeem you. Yeah. That's in 6. Verse six. Yes. So I will redeem you, or bring you out, or deliver you, some of you, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. Right. Any others?
It also mentions the burden of Egypt twice.
burden of Egypt, like the heaviness,
yeah.
The servitude.
And 6 and 7.
So 6, or is it
verses
6 and 7?
6 and 7, it comes twice, once in each verse.
So 6:6 and 6:7 talk about this burden of the Egyptians, this pressure, this weight, this servitude. You could pick up on that. Definitely in the Psalms, we have Psalms that pick up on that.
Can I share something which I guess is linked?
Yep, okay.
God gives Moses this incredible list of I wills and promises and covenants and his name and the whole lot. Moses tells Israelites, and they didn't listen to him. And that didn't listen to them because of all their hassles, because of their slavery, because of their discouragement, because of their burdens. It blew my mind because I'm sure, in a personal way, because it was to do with God says all these things to us here and in everywhere else, and we are so busy with the cares of the world and what all our hassles are that we don't listen. And it comes out time and again, it's not listening. And then he goes on to Pharaoh and says they won't listen. He says to God, the Lord.
What verse?
Well, in 10,
yes.
In 9, 6, 9, he says they won't listen.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 12, Moses says to the Lord, if the Israel won't listen, how the hell's Pharaoh going to listen?
Yeah, so not listening.
There's not listening. And, you know, we sing a sort of wonderful song, you know, open the
eyes of
my heart. And I always want to sing another verse, which is open the ears of my heart.
Right, so it's this plays into another theme that they could pick up on, especially in Jeremiah. We have, you know, uncircumcised
lips
or not lips there, but here we have lips. There in Jeremiah we have uncircumcised hearts, right? And so we also have uncircumcised ears. And uncircumcised lips here may not mean this stuttering or difficulty in speech, right? So if it follows the pattern of being uncircumcised organs, they're not able to do what they're intended to do, right? As far as ears and heart. What is an uncircumcised heart in Jeremiah and Deuteronomy?
So for me, it's feeling inadequate.
Inadequate or calloused, unable to harden, right? Hearing, well, that one's more easy. I mean, you can't listen well. We don't have any uncircumcised eyes, I don't think.
Well, you've got blind eyes, which is the same effect.
That's right. So what does uncircumcised lips? So this seems to, has been suggested that it's having to do with unworthiness. How could we think of, he's depressed, right? Moses is down. How am I going to take on Pharaoh?
Yeah.
And God encourages him in a surprising way. He says, you don't even have to speak to Pharaoh. I'm going to send it. You're the top dog. You don't have to talk. It's like a gangster movie or something like where you don't even see the bad guy, right? This is reverse, right? He sends his henchmen out, right? So Aaron's getting the dibs. He's getting the word from Moses. Moses has just to chill in the background, right? He doesn't have to worry. He doesn't have to even be the mouthpiece, right? You're okay. You're pure enough. So, and Aaron is really the mouthpiece, right? Aaron's the one talking to. So that comforts Moses, it seems, maybe. This is meant to comfort. This is God speaking to Moses here, so we'd imagine it would comfort him. But is it something deeper? And there's been suggestion among commentators, which I think is very suggestive and very interesting. Where else do we see the mouth or the tongue as being impure or pure in
Isaiah
speech?
Isaiah 6,
right?
Isaiah 6.
So you have these mouth cleansing purification ceremonies, it seems, whereby your mouth and your speech, which is reflective of your heart, needs to be repaired. Moses might be thinking he's not the most pure guy around. It might be much more.
He killed
so many, right? He's a naughty dude, right? He is the godfather. I mean, he is a henchman there. I mean, in that case, right? So he's thinking, I've got a mouth. I've got a purity problem, right? And that is very, I think, suggested if we go further on into the New Testament with anybody? Okay, James, right? I was thinking more purity issues. What's a purity issues with Jesus and Mark chapter 7 and food things, right? It's not what comes in your mouth, it's what comes out.
Oh, you're right.
All foods are clean, all, not all.
Yeah, the focus is the mouth there.
Yeah, so mouth.
So what goes into your mouth, what comes out of your heart.
Right, which is,
what
which
comes out of your mouth reflects,
it. it's a hierarchy. It's not saying that it doesn't matter at all, right? I mean, because you can't put like metal in your mouth and then swallow it, and, right? So it's not saying that it doesn't matter at all. But the priority is much, much greater, right? What really matters is what's reflected in your heart that comes out your mouth. And that kind of trumps it. So this...
And it
this,
ties up with Isaiah 6. Because in Isaiah 6,
yeah,
who am I but unclean lips?
That's
but the message is always go. I'm going to cleanse you, and you go. And you've got exactly the same thing here.
So
poor old Moses, you know, I've got unclean lips. You go to Pharaoh, and you do whatever.
So this is, I think, very interesting that it's not the same word structure in Hebrew, right? It might be translated. It'd be noteworthy to see what our translations do between Arel Svatayim, right? Which is 6:12, and back in 4:11. Right, no, I'm not talking about translations. I just said it's different. It's different. It has nothing to do except we have Lashon instead of Svatayim. We have Pei, right? So we have, in, let's just be together, 4:11. It's ki kavad pe ve kavad lashon anochi. So this is Moses complaining that has difficulty in speech, right? So if you look in your versions, please, in 4:11, and see how your translators deal with 4:11 in comparison to 6:12, which has aral svatayim, which has no continuity in word structure in Hebrew, right? So 4:11?
4:10 it is.
Sorry, 4:10.
I'm slow of speech and tongue in the NLB.
Okay. What else? What are some other translations of 4:10?
I am not eloquent here in the house.
Okay.
But I am slow of speech and of tongue.
Okay. Anybody else?
I am no orator.
I am what? Sorry?
Orator.
I'm no orator.
No orator.
Okay. Anybody else? Something different? I'm not a man of many words.
That's really loose.
Well, his tongue's heavy, so it takes a long time to get the word out.
Okay, let's look over now at 6.
If you go back
12,
to 6:12, Baruch, what is? I've got faltering lips, and in the Hebrew, it's.
Well, this is what we're getting to.
Arel, what is
uncircumcised.
Arel?
Uncircumcised.
Arel is actually uncircumcised.
Yeah. So this is what we're. This is
so
what our
really
point.
It's really mistranslated.
Well, let's let every other people share what 6:11 is in your versions. Anybody else? Rather than what do you?
I've
have?
Got faltering.
Faltering lips. Is that
yes.
12.
6:12. I'm sorry.
Difficulty.
6:12. Okay.
6:12. Yeah.
Uncultured.
Wow.
You got a real bad weird Bible, Sue. What?
Anybody else? None of them take a direction of.
We have uncircumcised.
Uncircumcised.
So it's good literal.
Yes,
he takes it very literal. I think it's nice as far as being able to ponder what that metaphor is trying to convey. He doesn't say, I'm heavy of tongue. I'm, you know, what's heavy of
mouth,
right? Or weighty, or whatever it means, right? So he says something else. I have uncircumcised. So I think it's helpful to look at what other organs are uncircumcised, right? So we have here, just to emphasize, we have uncircumcised lips. In other places, we have uncircumcised hearts, uncircumcised ears. We have, of course, uncircumcised other members. But that Well, that could also relate to maybe sexuality and things like that. That's more difficult to understand, maybe. But these other three passages are very clear from Jeremiah and Deuteronomy that we're not talking about some physical process.
Well, it's already a metaphor.
It's already a metaphor in the Torah, right? So Deuteronomy is the only one.
You can't circumcise any of these organs.
That's right.
So it's already,
right.
You're already speaking metaphorically.
This is metaphorical, and we have metaphorical heart, because Shoshi Pressman is like, what are we other numbers in the Torah, right? My wife. So what other members or whatever usages of this metaphor within the Torah, not just later prophetic literature, which might take off on the physical, right? But you actually have lips here, and you have heart in Deuteronomy. So it seems to be an established metaphor that means something deeper than...
If you go back to the original Brit Milah, the original
circumcision,
it seems to me, I don't know if this is metaphorical, but you're doing it for two reasons. One is to become a member or a part of the people of God. It's an identification, but it's also in some way to do with a cleansing. I mean, it's very interesting that in modern terms, people circumcise their kids, not for any religious or whatever reason,
right,
but because they know, basically, it's a good thing.
I mean, I don't want to spend too much more time on this because it's a very rich chapter, but we can remember that two chapters prior to this, we have Moses not circumcising his son,
right,
and Zipporah doing her job.
Right.
She's this daughter of a Midian priest, and she's circumcising their son. You'd think that Moses would have got it, right? He's the lawgiver, and he doesn't do it. The angel of death is about to kill him,
right,
and then the foreskin saves his rear end, right? So, saves his life. The blood, there is some sort of salvific element. So there are deeper things here, but I think we'll keep it just to highlight that aras fataim is not, or the word uncircumcised lips, is not the same in 6:12 here as it is in 4:11, right? So that's the main point. And so it suggest something a little bit deeper.
Can I say one more thing? Her point on Isaiah, the connection to Isaiah 6, you have the synonym where it's not uncircumcised of lips, but it's unclean of lips, tmei svatayim. And in the NET translation, they say, for my lips are contaminated by sin. So they go more with that maybe purity or
Isaiah
6 of all.
Is often understood that more in that direction because it is this purification before sending out. Very clear.
Yeah.
This is more subtle or something.
Well, tameh and arel can be synonyms elsewhere. So uncircumcised and impure are kind of in your same category. One's a metaphor, one's kind of more straight language.
Right.
Remind me what a synonym is in English.
They mean the same thing. Where they're in the same field.
Right.
They're in the same ballpark.
Words that mean
Words that are similar in function or meaning. Yeah, so this is rich. Okay, but we're going to continue on and go back to that beginning comment. What's one of the main themes? That I am Yud Hey Vav Hey. I thought someone might suggest I appeared, right? I appeared, because this is a Vayera. The typical Parsha name for this passage is I appeared, right, to Abraham, Isaac. So this is a theme within Abraham's stories, and later theophanies and prophets and God hearing, you know, the prophets hearing from God, but no one talked about that. But that is a subtle theme, I think. In verse 1 and verse 2, we have this seeing metaphor and appearing metaphor. Who is he now appearing as? He is not just El Shaddai. He is Yud Hey Vav Hey. So now we're going to come back to your point. El Shaddai.
How come here? Because apparently this is God speaking. How come his name is written with yod instead of an olive here?
It's always, I think it's with a yod.
He's referring to the first time he introduced himself. He says,
It's with an olive, but here it's with the yod.
Well, sometimes I introduce myself as, you know, Baruch, Brian, Scott, Kwasnika. Sometimes I just say I'm Brian, you know. So I would say that's the kind of fuller version, first name, last name. I'm joking a little bit, right? But the point is that this captures in a short chunk, that word may very well capture a broader meaning of Yeh and Yeh, the verse that you're starting with a, I will be.
There's different people that say that when God, he's speaking himself, it's first person, right?
You know, that, and we definitely have that one occurrence of it. I don't know of others, but we're not going to, if that's okay, we're not going to focus too much on that. But your first question, I think, is very important. And so El Shaddai and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton. It is true that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh appears prior. So how is it now that they didn't know his name?
Moses wrote it.
Well, that's one maybe way out of it, but if we hold that the text affirms what was said more literally or something, then we can understand that they knew of the name, but they hadn't experienced the name, right? And so there's different words. The verb here is not just a general knowing. It can be understood as knowing more intimately or experiencing. And in a covenant contract, I understand from ancient Near East Eastern scholars, this is the way a contract or a covenant is set up. Like you are now appearing as this person with this name. You may have heard, they knew the name before, but they hadn't experienced the name. Now God is showing up, the deity is showing up in power and in strength. They didn't know, experientially know. Maybe that's a nice, that might be a nice translation, I think. Experientially know. They did not experientially know the power of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. They knew El Shaddai, but they hadn't experienced intimately, personally, right? They hadn't known of the promises. It had been promised. That's coming up too. Letet lehem et eretz Canaan. To give. Had they been given the land of Canaan?
Yeah, they promised it.
Exactly, that's the tension. Have they been given? We assume giving the land, grasping, experiencing it, right? But they hadn't possessed it. He had to buy that one plot in Hebron. Right. That's it, right?
Yeah.
Was he given the land?
No.
He was given in the sense of promised, but that's one, I think, meaning. But he hadn't experienced the land. He hadn't lived and possessed.
What you're saying is that they didn't grasp the full meaning of his name.
Not only that they didn't grasp mentally, they hadn't experienced the, we can put it in charismatic sense, they hadn't experienced the Holy Spirit power.
Indwelling.
The indwelling of the presence that bowled them over. I mean, they're about to experience something that is phenomenal, right?
It says in 6:2. I did not make myself fully known to them.
That's
yeah,
right.
Okay, they knew the name. Yeah. It's like, but I knew your name for years.
But I really want to, yeah, okay, so I really want to emphasize that it's not just new.
It's just experience.
I love it. It's got to be deeper than this, because they knew the name prior.
Right.
In all these contracts, I guess in ancient Near East, the people know this name, but the guy, the king, the deity, shows up with a new name or something that's known, but now is experienced a new way because he has empowered himself, and we're talking now humanly speaking, empowered himself as king and is ruling. So they're going to experience the kingly rule of God, boom, right? You've known about this king far off. Now you are going to live it, right?
It's like you in friendships. Like someone can say, you know so-and-so. Oh, yeah. I kind of know them. I know who they are, but that doesn't mean you really know them.
That's right.
And like the second one would be like that good friend where you're like, yes, I know that person.
Well, perhaps if you think of it in terms of the military, you know, you're a private soldier and you know that the general's first name is Timothy, but do you call him Tim?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, you don't.
And you know.
Yeah, but again, I want to... Yeah, I want to encourage just this experience, right? Okay, sorry, yeah.
But they did have an experience of God's presence, a personal one. Like when Abraham had that personal covenant with God, when God walked with him between the cut animals.
Correct, right.
And Jacob did wrestle with an angel that was representative of God.
Right.
God.
It wasn't national. It wasn't... communal, it was more individual, I would say.
Abraham
this is
was
now
asleep.
A kingly power. This is a contract. This is a...
And some of that may have been forgotten in Egypt, because it seems like there's a little bit of a breakdown.
Yeah, there's maybe, you know, your great-great-grandfather experiencing this cutting which isn't found here, but it's Hakimoti Brit, which is also interesting. I set up or stand a covenant. I don't cut a covenant, which is unique here. I guess among priestly writers, one commenter says, "Yeah, he'd be cutting up himself if this covenant was to be actuated or something realized," which I thought, well, there is something to that.
With
Yeshua, I mean, much later. Right?
And so if you go look back to Abraham and walking through, I mean, he's more or less saying, "I will become myself." I mean, it is messianic.
Right.
In a real sense.
Excuse me,
doesn't it all point to faith and trust in God? Because remember Caleb and Joshua, and God told Joshua everywhere he stepped his foot to possess the land, he would possess the land. So maybe they didn't have the faith to believe in the promise of the land at that point.
I think, we won't go too far in that direction because it's very rich and complicated. But, I mean, there's these 400 and some years, the Amorites, the sin of the Amorites, what is the sin of the Amorites? God giving grace and time. He wants probably the Amorites to be saved, but they're just sick with sin. And then finally giving them over, and then Israel possessing and things like that. So I think there is an element of faith.
Faith and trust. Yes.
Faith and trust, I'm sure, are part of this. We have this element of Abraham believing, right? And this is resting on that, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? He does Vegam in verse 4 and again in 5, I think. He has this very strong contract language, Vegam Hakimoti.
Also, Vegam, it's very strong.
I guess it's typical affirmation that this is happening. That's an oath. You know, God lifts up his hands, his hand, which we still do today when we have an oath, right? So God lifts up his hand, and it's literally kind of and oaths this or promises this to bring you to the land which I swore to your father, for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So they were given; they haven't received. Let's go back to these seven verbs now that were mentioned. These seven verbs, can you see them in verses 5, 4, 5, 6?
It starts in 6, I think.
Is it 6? Okay. First of all, God remembers his covenant. It's not that he forgot, but it's much deeper than that. He empathizes. He connects.
It's what we were talking about in the sermon last week. That remembering means doing something
about
it.
That's right. So he's now acting on his covenant, and he says, "I have brought them out from this servitude of this heavy burden, right? I've saved, I've redeemed with this outstretched arm." So we have this image here, both here in Isaiah 42, we get here of a yad, of a hand, and how this is related to kingly power. What are some of the other ones? Maybe the most intimate. Ve'lekachti. It's a simple word. Ve'lekachti etchem li'le'am ve'hayti lechem le'elohim. So now I have not, and I've lifted you up, I've taken you, I've adopted you. Some one person has said, this is adoptive language, right? God is taking or marrying or adopting the people of Israel. And this fulfills many of those functions of adopting. I want to highlight in Hebrews maybe a possible wordplay that in this verse 6 we have ubesvatim shvatim gdolim. Ubesvatim gdolim. We see this two or three times here. It's not an uncommon word. These judgments or great acts, right, with an outstretched arm. What does it say in your verses?
Outstretched arm.
Great judgments. Verse 6. You see that?
With an outstretched arm and great judgments.
And
with mighty acts of judgment.
Mighty acts. Yeah? So this is a homonym with Sfatayim, right? Aral Sfatayim. Different spelling, but it's interesting that, you know, he's claiming he's got these lips that are not strong and impure and things like that. I'm going to show up with Sfatayim Gdolim, right? These great acts. I don't know. It's just it sounds the same. One wonders if God is countering, or the author is countering this, and there's just a similar sound there.
I've lost it in the
Hebrew. The lips, the word for lips and the word for judgments here, or acts, sounds the same. There's one letter difference. I just want to highlight that, you know. You think you've got these lips, bad lips, and impure heart. I'm going to show up with something that rhymes. I don't know. Great dibs. No, I don't know. I'm going to come up with great actions that are going to wash away those poor lips, those impure lips. Okay, moving on to verse 8. Nasati et yedei letet ota le'Avraham Yitzchak. So this is where God lifts up his hand and he swears the oath that he is going to give this land. Lechem morasha ani Adonai. So he's going to give it as an inheritance. It hasn't been realized. It's been given in faith. It hasn't been given in reality.
Oh, that's good. So the word in Hebrew is morasha.
Yep.
In verse 8.
Yes.
Because, yeah. I mean, that makes it clearer. Because a morasha is a heritage. Yeah. And you're actually going to get your inheritance. So, which is what you were saying. I mean, you've been promised it all, and you've known for years that you're going to get it, and now you've got the action; it's being worked out.
Amen. 7:7 is the conclusion of our parsha. 7:5 really hammers home the point again that the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. I would say if we have any major theme of the Exodus narrative, is that people, maybe the Bible. Okay, we get this later. That all the nations will know, right? Mm-hmm. That his name will be known among all the nations. That he will be known among the Egyptians. That Moses will realize that Yud Hey Vav Hey has just shown up, not just El Shaddai. That I am the Lord. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. This is the major theme of the scriptures in many ways, and of our parsha. This is the link that our prophetic passages highlight. Right, of knowing the name of the Lord. That does not mean, again, I repeat, not knowing cognitively the name of God. We don't need to pronounce it in a certain way. We don't need to say it in a certain way. We don't need to assent to it in belief. We need to experience it, right? We need to live in the presence of the name of God, right? Not know, I know the name of God. You know, this is found in 7:5 and picked up in our passages in Isaiah 42. Before we turn there, I failed just to highlight something that I found interesting in preparing for this, that El Shaddai only occurs 39 times, and it's only in poetic passages. So that means it's very archaic, except for two occurrences, which is explainable. So El Shaddai, this name of God, which has many parallels in ancient Near East literature in some ways, is very obtuse, very unclear as what it means. And we won't go into all that. We've got lots of options from the Syriac, the Greek, ancient translations, often meaning the rock, the one of the mountain. He is sufficient, all sufficient, strong one. We're going to leave it all behind and say, in a sense, it doesn't matter so much because El Shaddai is this ancient known version of God, right? He shows up as Yud Hey Vav Hey, and it sort of overwhelms the scriptures, right? No longer is he, it's clear from scriptures, right? 39 times in comparison to oodles, you know, numerous times of God's name. And so we see that this fits very well the historic narrative. We have three names in Scripture that have El Shaddai in them for people's names, or Shaddai. And all of those are from Numbers chapter 1 and 2. They're very archaic. And so everything about that fits the narrative. El Shaddai is ancient, it's poetic, it's archaic, and now God's presence, Yud Hey Vav Hey, is the more modern, or more known, and experienced. Okay, let's jump to our prophetic passage and highlight Isaiah 42.
How come where God says, I'll make Moses a God, and Pharaoh, right?
Yeah.
But he uses the word Elohim.
That's right, yeah. Now, I only alluded to that. That's my the gangster image, right? Of like, of yeah, it's fascinating knowledge. So Moses appears or functions as God. He's like the divine oracle to Aaron. And Aaron is Moses' prophet, it says, like you said. So Moses is the cloaked white figure. I don't know, Gandalf. I don't know, you know,
he's God to Pharaoh, but he's not a God.
Right, right. No, there's very, yeah, no, for sure. He's not.
A lot of God, probably.
Right, and we have the battle of the gods, right? They're very real here, and God does battle against the gods of Egypt and overcomes them. That's one of the main themes of this of Exodus, right? And to say that there aren't other gods is not biblical, right? There are principalities and powers in the Tanakh, in the New Testament. There are other gods. There's just no other god like the one God, right?
So we're just talking.
Yeah.
Pharaoh is sort of depicted as the son of
nice, very nice, yeah.
With divine status.
Right. Yeah.
So when they set up this arrangement with Moses and Aaron, they say, well, Aaron's on your level, but
right.
Moses is.
Right. Yeah, it definitely empowers Moses, and it definitely heightened the attention, because Pharaoh is known as a god, right? And so the rivals now, they're not just Moses. We imagine this little humble, can't-speak person. Now we can maybe imagine his God versus God, you know, a God. So, nice. Isaiah 42. Let's jump there in the last couple of minutes. Isaiah 42, verses 8 through 21. And verses 8 through 21. I'm just going to peruse out loud with you. Isaiah 42, 8. I am the Lord. That is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things have come to pass. Now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them. So you hear very strong emphasis, both within 42 and 52, that the issue here is the presence of God, the name of God, right? Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey. If we went back a little bit, we would have the theme of covenant. And light to the nations, that's verse 6, but our passage starts in verse 8. We have then in verse 14 issues related to limbs or organs, right, of blindness. And so that we could have some connections there. I will lead the blind in a way they do not know, in path they do not, I will guide them. And then verse 17, we have this engagement, we could say, also with idols, right? Exodus is God overcoming the idols or the gods of Egypt. Verse 17, they will be turned back and utterly be put to shame. We trust in idols who say to molten images, who are our gods? Hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. So we have the issue of not hearing, right? In Moses' case, in Pharaoh's case, and hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. Who is blind but my servant? Or who's so deaf as my messenger whom I send? Verse 20, you have seen many things, but you do not observe them. Your ears are open, but none hears. The Lord was pleased for his righteousness' sake to make the Torah great and glorious. So this is the end of our passage for the prophets. You can see some of those themes there. Very quickly, 52, our time is finished. Just to highlight that, the name or presence experienced name of God is again highlighted. So 52:6 is where we start, but boy, if we could just look at 52:1 and include that, you know, it might, sometimes our scholars who deal with these Torah portions and prophetic portions say that there might have been a wiggle room to latch on verses prior or definitely at the end. But I want to latch on just before, because why? 52, awake, awake, clothe yourself in strength, O Zion, clothe yourself in beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for the uncircumcised and the unclean will no longer come into you. So you have these themes of unclean and uncircumcised. Shake yourself from the dust, Rise up, O captive Jerusalem. Now we'll jump ahead to the six. Therefore, my people shall know my name. So this is the official beginning of the second prophetic passage. 52:6. What it says? My people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, I am the one who, in speaking, here I am. And it goes on with this amazing vision. How lovely are the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who announces peace and brings good news and happiness, who announces salvation, and says to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen lift up their voices. They shout joyfully, for they will see with their own eyes when the Lord restores Zion. Break forth, shout joyfully together, you waste places of Jerusalem, for the people has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm. You see that, yeah? In the sight of all the nations, that all the ends of the earth may see. Here we get not just Egypt, the whole ends, this vision. Earth may see the salvation, Yeshua, of our God.
Hallelujah.
Thanks be to God. Shabbat shalom.
See eye to eye, the Lord restoring Zion.